The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 537 for Sunday, January 25th, 2015. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, cool stuff found, and your tales of woe. We share your tales of woe. We share our tales of woe. We share your questions, your tips, your cool stuff found. We answer your questions. The goal every time we get together is to learn more than one new thing about the Apple Mac products, lines, technology, life in general. Sponsor for this episode is Squarespace. At squarespace.com/MGG. Squarespace will give you 10% off of your first purchase with coupon code MGG so you can build and host your website with them. We'll talk more about that later in the show here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And back here in Durham, New Hampshire is Pilot Pete. Thanks for having me, guys.
It's good to have you, Pete.
Yeah, it's good to be here on this lovely day where it's just like Miami without all that nasty heat and humidity.
That's right. Yeah, nobody needs any of that.
Yeah.
Not here anyway. John, on Wednesday, I think, weather permitting, and who knows what the weather's going to bring us in New England, but I think I'm going to be down in your neck of the woods-ish speaking for the, hold on, I want to get their name right. Looking at it.
Oh, here. You hooked up with those guys.
Yeah, yeah. The ctmac.org group in Farmington at the UConn campus is where the meeting is. So that's Wednesday night. I think it's 6:30 when that starts.
So yeah, I visited Mac them a while connection. Ago.
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. And the I got ahead of the pitchforks and the torches.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, I appreciate you paving the way, because otherwise it's going to be a bad scene when I get there. So, yeah, you should come up if the weather permits and you're around.
That'd be kind of fun. Wednesday you're doing this?
Yeah.
Oh, the mess should be gone by then. Yeah.
It should.
Well, they actually, now we got. Yeah, so the snow we just got was wimpy, but now I see we have actually a blizzard warning.
Which, right.
That's serious.
Yeah, they're saying it could snow for 24 to 36 hours. So
just a nor'easter.
Awesome.
It's just another nor'easter. Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about managing your mobile life, and I've kind of done some updates on that one. So it should be fun talking about how to access everything when you're not in your home environment and make it feel like home. So we'll talk all about that. We'll have some fun together. So. Yeah, come on up. And in fact, we should look at, again, just weather permitting, we should look at our schedules and figure all that out. So, sweet.
Yeah. So, I'm trying something new, Dave.
What are you trying?
Well, sadly, so, you know, we changed our workflow a bit.
Right.
Well, no, that's not the sad part, but... the sad part is that so we changed our workflow and I needed to add a Twitter account to my Twitter environment.
Okay.
And the client that I was using just freaked out, totally freaked out. Yoru Fukuru, say that carefully, which means night owl, I think, in Japanese. But
okay.
I got to the page where, you know, it's supposed to go through the authorization for a new account, and it just got stuck in like an endless loop. It was like, whoa, that token's bad. Whoa, that's bad. It just went round. The author is kind of MIA, or I couldn't get an answer. So I'm like, yeah, I'll try something new. So actually, I actually spent some money on an app here. So I actually decided to give a Twitterific. I think it's actually on sale now. It's a pretty nice client so far. The thing that I like, which the one I didn't use, did not have, or the one I was using did not have, is a tweet marker.
Okay.
It's like, dude, yeah. How did I live without this? It's so cool. So there's both iOS and OS X clients, and wherever you start or wherever you stop reading, it kind of places a virtual bookmark, and then if you pick it up on another machine, it starts you off there. So you can, whereas before, you know, I kind of had to manually go through my feed to find out where I left off, because I try to read every tweet.
That's impressive, my friend. I admire you for that. I don't.
Yeah, it's a neat client.
I don't read every tweet. I can't. I read replies and I'll read, if I go on Twitter, I'll read things from the last 20 minutes or whatever and you know, catch up and join the conversation. And then that's that. But I don't try to go back and read everything. But that, it's what you do is great. I think it's admirable, as I said.
But it's nice. It facilitates now being able to do that better. Because I think in the past, I just wouldn't know where I left off. So I, you know, did my best to, you know, go as far back as I could.
Sure.
But that's my choice for now. There's a few weird things that it doesn't do quite right. But now your preference, though. Well, you advised me that you use a different one. And of course, you know, I never listened to you.
Right.
At least to start. But I think your choice is a different client for the time being, Dave.
Yeah. So on the Mac, I've tried lots of them. I haven't tried all of them, but I just use Twitter's client, which started out as Tweety, and then they hired Lauren and acquired Tweety and made it the official Twitter client. It works. I actually really like the UI. I mean, it you know, and that's the beauty of it, is it's not for everybody, and that's awesome. But for the way I use Twitter, and I have multiple accounts, and I can easily see at a glance if there's notifications, and I can customize those, but you know, I can see if there's replies to like the Mac Geek Gab account, even if I'm looking at my Dave Hamilton account on Twitter. So yeah. So I like the official Twitter app there. On iOS, I mostly use Tweetbot. I have not tried Tweetbot for the Mac. I suppose I should. Maybe I would like that. But on iOS, I mostly use Tweetbot. I went through a period where I was using Twittolator, and I still like that. I like the way it shows photos in line, and I probably should go back to that now that more and more photos are coming in tweet streams. But Tweetbot seems to work. I like it. It's good. I think Tweetbot, it does. Tweetbot does its own syncing. I think it uses iCloud to sync its you know, where you are in the stream and what you've read and all that good stuff.
Yeah, this will let you choose. It'll say, you know, you want me to use TweetMarker, which I imagine has some sort of infrastructure you can tie into, or it says, or would you like to use iCloud for your synchronization?
Sure.
Yeah, it's and I also, what I probably should have done is actually add them. So I didn't have all of my Twitter, because yeah, it doesn't do quite the right thing for replies and stuff like that. It did have Growl tie-in.
Okay.
But it doesn't anymore for some reason. So, and I actually found, you know, they said, well, yeah, we're kind of working on that. So, use the official Twitter, you know, mechanism built into the OS to handle that.
Right.
Which of course means you should go into internet accounts, system preferences, internet accounts. And, you know, I added, all of my, Twitters that I have access to there.
Sure.
So now I'll see replies, I guess, you know, notification center or on the screen on my, iOS devices. So
right yeah, cool. It's fun. Twitter's a good thing. You know, since we're talking about Twitter, I've already mentioned I'm Dave Hamilton, he's Pilot Pete, he's John F. Braun. Of course the show is Mac Geek Gab, so if you want to follow us all on Twitter while you're trying out these new clients, that's where we're at.
And Mac Observer, which is
the one
that I added because we had a, you know, like I mentioned, a slight change in our workflow, so I needed access to that.
And, right.
Yeah, and I'll be careful.
Right. Yeah, that's all right. That's good. Yeah. So let's you know, while we're on the social thing, we'll just get all of it out of the way. Check out our new Facebook group, MacGeekGab.com/Facebook or Facebook.com/group/MacGeekGab, however you want to do it. Awesome group growing there. So we've got, I mean, it's happening in both places. Google Plus, killer group growing there. And then in Facebook, the group's a week old and it's already got, there's a ton of traffic. In fact, you know, I posted something, John, I think we're, we have a question, and so I'm going to loop right in here because it ties all in together. I posted that I'm having, and I've always had a problem with my Apple TV, John. When I go to use it, it appears on the network. I can appear to choose it for AirPlay streaming if I want. If I go on the Apple TV, just without doing AirPlay, I can see the YouTube app and I can see movies and all of that stuff, and it works great. However, when I go to do anything, it, you know, the Apple TV responds. Even if I try to do AirPlay, it's obvious that there's a connection there. Something happens. The screen goes black and the little progress wheel in the middle starts to spin. Same thing happens if I go to play a movie. It'll, you know, start to play, but it'll say you got a buffer, but it'll take forever. It will never happen. Or if it does start, it starts and then it stops and fits. And if I simply go and reset it, which is, you know, just restart it, which I think you can access on the Apple TV in settings, general restart, it comes right back up and everything works fine. So a restart totally solves it. It had gotten to the point where, you know, I use a Harmony remote, John. So I just added a restart. There is a remote control command for restart. It doesn't require any confirmation. You send the command and the unit restarts. It doesn't exist on the Apple remote, of course, but there is a command that it will receive, and the Harmony remote knows it, and or the Harmony system knows it, and the remote will send it. So I just added it as a thing. Turn on the Apple TV, turn on my TV, turn on my audio amplifier, restart the Apple TV. And it would be an extra minute and a half or whatever, but it would work, because all we were doing was it would get back. It would get up. We would navigate through the remote commands and we'd tell it to restart. So it was easy enough just to have it do it in an automated way. But I posted, and we had listener John who wrote in and was having similar problems, saying that he couldn't keep his iPad connected over AirPlay to his Apple TV. It would start to work and it wouldn't. And so it's a Gen 3 Apple TV is what we're talking about here. So the current generation of Apple TV. And so I posted in our Facebook group about this, John, because it was driving me crazy. And I had a slew of responses. Some people posted that there is an unpublished but official Apple recall on Apple TVs of that ilk. Now, mine doesn't fit the serial number list that was leaked out. You know, 9to5Mac or somebody found the list of serial numbers that the geniuses have. And mine doesn't fit into that range, although some people, again, on that same Facebook thread mentioned, well, try anyway. You might get a replacement. Allison Sheridan over at podfeet.com, she does the NoSillaCast. She ran into this a couple of months ago, and she and Steve called AppleCare, and they found advised her of a solution. I'm actually going to look up the article so I can put it in the show notes. But what they said was you hold down get your Apple TV started up, get the regular Apple, you know, the remote that came with it. Hold down the menu button on the remote and the down arrow for 6 seconds. Once you've held it for 6 seconds, nothing will happen until you release. When you release, it reboots. But Apple told them this is a special type of reboot. It's not a normal reset, and it will fix this problem. Now, we know that a reset fixes the problem for me in the short term. So I've done this. It hasn't been long enough for me to say whether or not this will fix it long term. But Allison and Steve from NoSillaCast both said that this solved it for them long term. So we will check it out.
Yeah. And a note in the chat room says that the light will start flickering on the front of the Apple TV once you've hit that 6 second mark. It'll let you know that,
okay,
you know, that it's going to reboot when you release. Okay.
So something does happen.
Yeah.
That's good to know. Okay, cool.
Thank you, BSD Junkie.
Yeah, at MacGeekUp.com/stream. So yeah, it's great stuff. I mean, obviously a relevant question, but really shows the value of these Facebook and Google Plus groups is you've just got the hive mind happening for you all week long, 24 hours a day. I posted this Friday night at about 1 a.m. By 2 a.m., I had everything except Allison and Steve's solution. They had yet to post anything. But I mean, there was probably, you know, 15 comments on there within an hour in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So
nothing else to do in the middle of the night.
I know. Yeah. So,
of course, they could be on lunch break in Sydney. You know.
Right. Right. That's right. But that's okay. That's kind of how
it's now a small world.
Yeah. Well, that's what it is. Is it? Yeah. It keeps the world small. So good stuff. All right. So let's now that I've jumped us all over the agenda, why don't we go to for the first one? We've got some follow ups from recent shows that are worth going through here. We'll start with Harrison. Harrison said in last week's show, we were talking about screen capture, video screen capture tools. And he said the one you missed was Snagit from TechSmith.com for $50. He says, I love it. I do a ton of screencasts and screenshots and easy annotations and editing. It's on my short list of must have apps for my Mac. So there you go. Thank you, Harrison. Good stuff. We will, as usual, we will put that in the show notes too. Have you ever tried that one, John? Snagit?
No,
huh? Yeah, I haven't.
Nope.
There's a lot of them. There's like, you know, there's Telestream, and I mean, the Telestream is a different company we were talking about before, but all these, I feel like there's all these companies that begin with T, with products that begin with S that do this screen casting. Screen Flow is one of them, right? That falls into
you
that.
You just
category.
Have to go down your applications folder one app at a time.
I know.
Until you find it. But
yeah, yeah. There's too many. Yeah. I can't keep them all in my head.
That's at techsmith.com for $49.95.
There you go. Yeah. So it's a nickel off of the $50. Harrison's trying to make an extra nickel. Oh, it's not. Harrison doesn't work there. He just recommended it. All right, sweet. Also in show 536, we were talking about that that MacBook that had liquid damage, and we suggested Apple flat rate repair because flat rate repair, I mentioned, was about $350, and there was this $750 price that came in. Several of you wrote in to correct us and enlighten us on this. That actually was that $750 or whatever that price was a flat rate repair price. Apple has tiers, Rick says, for flat rate repair pricing. Many of you do say this. Liquid spills are the highest tier because of all the damage it can create. So that would be a tier 4 repair, which is almost as much as a new Mac. It varies by model. The $349 flat rate would not apply if there's liquid damage. So that's actually really good to know. I didn't realize that that there were different tiers of that, John. I've only ever used the first tier of flat rate repair.
Oh, that makes sense because, yeah, when I brought my iPhone in, it seems as a regular course of action when they take something in for repair.
Yeah,
I remember they had a little box or something on the work order, and it said confirmed liquid, liquid damage detector was not on.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think every modern iOS and Mac, or at least portable Mac, I think have that liquid damage detector somewhere in there.
Somewhere in the chain. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So does it void your warranty to open that up and replace that liquid?
It depends on, you know, Pete, there's a phrase we like to share here at Mackie. Yeah, that's right. I think that would apply.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, that's right. John Harrison, I believe it's the same Harrison, but I am, it doesn't matter. But I believe you had an interaction with Harrison as well this week about a follow-up from something we talked about in the previous show.
Well, he interacted with us.
Oh, that's good.
But so Harrison said that he's finally caught up on his Mac Geek Gab backlog.
For you to say, John.
Yeah.
But he said we didn't indicate a use case. So I kind of threw this in towards the end of a recent episode. And I said, hey, you know, there's this cool RAM disk thing that I just checked out here. And because I have a lot of RAM in my machine, I thought, well, what the heck? And, you know, as far as a disk, this is going to be the fastest disk, even faster than an SSD, because the RAM in your computer is fast.
Sure.
Or should be.
Right. Right. Yeah, fair point.
So he said, all right, so he said he has a RAM disk and he's been using it for a while and he just wanted to give us a heads up as to what the heck can you do with it. So he's a very active Plex user. And he has a dedicated machine, I guess a Mac Mini, i7, 16 gigs RAM, Samsung SSD to run Plex and it's transcoding. So he's going through the configuration when all of a sudden he saw this one entry. And what it is, it's the transcoder temporary directory. So I guess when it's doing its thing, it needs some space, temporary space, throwaway space, that it can do this sort of thing. And then all of a sudden he put two and two together and said, hey, why don't I enter a RAM disk as this entry in the Plex settings? And that's the use case.
Brilliant.
Hey, it's great. Yeah.
I'm going to do it today.
Yeah.
You're doing it, huh? There you go.
Because I guess some programs still, give the user the ability to do this sort of thing. Actually, the only other thing that I'm aware of, and I don't know if it would make sense to do it, may want to try it, if you are a user of Photoshop, they actually have some suggestions on how to optimize performance. And one is, we have this scratch space as well.
Yeah.
Now, what they say, it's interesting. What they say is that, we'll use the scratch space when there's not enough memory. So in theory, most programs, if they need to do something quickly, they should use RAM. But sometimes they don't, or I guess don't do it properly. So, if you have extra RAM, set up a RAM disk and use it for temporary scratch space, and you may see a big boost in performance.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about that from a programming standpoint, John. If you're doing something like a video transcode, where essentially what you have to do is read from one file and then save to another, and then let that the resulting file be the one that streams. Obviously, the big issue is doing that on the same disk, right? Because if you're reading gobs of data from one disk and then writing gobs of data back to that disk after the CPU does some operation on it, that can be a very pardon me, that can be a very slow process, right? Because the disk can't, it's not optimized to read and write simultaneously like that. So writing somewhere else, anywhere else, would be a good thing. A RAM disk is obviously very fast. But I'm thinking from a programming standpoint, would you just want to save all that in RAM? Probably not with a big video transcode like that, right? I mean, you kind of want to, for a lot of reasons. One is just data integrity, but the other is, whatever engine you're using to then stream the resulting data out may be more built to read from a file descriptor as opposed to RAM, right? So, but a piece of software could create its own RAM disk. I mean, that there's nothing wrong with that from a, if that's the problem you're trying to solve.
Sure.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's fun stuff. I love doing it. It's a great, great use case. I love it. John, a couple of shows ago, I think it was 535, we were talking about DrivePulse, which is the monitoring engine that's built into Drive Genius. And Drive Genius 4's DrivePulse includes the ability to monitor login items. And we were talking about whether or not the engine monitored the actual login items that you have in System Preferences, which is a plist, versus which is controlled with a plist, versus the login, the startup daemons and startup items and launch daemons and all that stuff, which are individual plists that are dumped into a folder. In fact, DrivePulse monitors all of that. And I actually noticed it about 2 hours after we finished the show and forgot to put it on our list. But Bob, Dr. Mac Levitis wrote in and reminded us. Yes, in fact, it does. So thanks, Bob, for the reminder and the heads up. That's good stuff. It is nice to know when that changes. Sort of one thing I've noticed that's weird is I have a couple of network volumes mount when I boot my Mac, and DrivePulse comes up and tells me the volume has been removed from my login items and then added to my login items every single time. And I have no idea where that comes from. Obviously, I've never seen that before because I've never had something obsessively monitoring that. Do you do network volume mounting? I mean, is it something wonky about? Remember, this week I just migrated to the Retina iMac, which is friggin' awesome. I mean, it's like really awesome. But so I don't know if it's part of the migration assistant that did that, because I didn't notice it before, and I had it on this one, which is now the 27 I used to have, now lives up here in the studio, so we have gobs of horsepower. Yay! Finally. So that's good.
Good to go for another 10 years.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I've noticed, if I run the Drobo dashboard, it alerts me that some plist has changed.
Okay.
Or keeps changing. It said, well, I deleted it and then I rewrote this. The one weird thing that I find about the dialogue, Dave, it's kind of disconcerting and kind of confusing to me, is when this dialogue does come up saying, hey, a plist file changes, there are two options. One is ignore and the other is show in Finder. And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, the ignore to me is kind of misleading. It's like, well, I'm not really ignoring the fact that this happened. I'm more acknowledging it. The first time I saw that, I was just like, what exactly am I saying here? You know, I don't know. Just seemed to be a weird choice to acknowledge that you've seen this happen.
Right. Right.
I think
is
what you're doing when you say, but to me, ignore doesn't embrace what you're really doing. You're not ignoring the fact that it happened. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for telling me.
Yeah. Thanks for the heads up. Yo, that's right. Yeah. I don't know.
All right.
And then finally, there's one bit of this last one from Don, this little heads up that I did not test. But Don says back in show 536, you recommended to someone that they use the Kinex Thunderbolt to USB connector to hook up a USB based SSD boot drive. The manufacturer specifically states that this connector cannot be used for a USB boot drive. So if your listener doesn't read this specification, he's going to have a big problem. I know that because I installed an SSD on my 2011 iMac, similar to what you were talking about. I did all the research first with a little help from you guys. So thank you, Don. Yeah. And I tested this. I tested that part of it. You're absolutely right. It just doesn't show up as a boot disk. The same drive will show up as a boot disk when plugged in natively to USB on the Mac, or of course, if the same drive is plugged in, you can boot over Thunderbolt. Cause I have a LaCie rugged, it's actually a 500 gig SSD external. It's awesome. And I use it when I travel. I have half of it as a clone of my MacBook Air's boot drive. And then the other half is just storage. So that way, if I have a problem while I'm traveling, I have a clone of my boot drive, and it's awesome. Cause it's got a built in, Thunderbolt cable that never comes off, and it's got a USB 3 connector on it. So I was able to test all of this with one drive, and I plugged the drive in directly, either Thunderbolt or USB, which on my 2011 Air is USB 2, it would show up in the boot list and boot just fine. But if I connected it USB 3 to the Kinex Thunderbolt connector, that would not work. So the question that I did not answer before this show, but I will, is that a limitation of all Thunderbolt docks, or is it just a limitation of the Kinex Thunderbolt dock? And that Kinex one is kind of a unique thing because it's just a little dongle. It's bus powered, which may be part of the issue here, but actually probably not. No, it's bus powered. It's got, I think it's $79, and it's got a USB 3 and gigabit Ethernet connectors right on it, which is killer for someone like me with a 2011 Air. But it will not boot over that USB 3 port on it. But I don't know if that's a limitation with just the Kinex dock or if it's a limitation with others. So I'm going to test that, and I apologize for not doing that before the show. But so there you go. It's an interesting little thing, John. Have you messed with Thunderbolt yet?
No. I have a Thunderbolt port.
Right.
On my refurb here, but no, I don't have anything to plug into it as of yet.
Okay. So, okay.
I have to work on that. Should probably get a video adapter so I can hook my big screen TV up to it.
Yeah. So you need, one of these Thunderbolt docks. I like that has HDMI in it, like the, I can't remember. I know the new Otherworld Computing one does. That's actually a Thunderbolt 2 dock, but of course that works on your Thunderbolt 1 machine. But I can't remember if there's anything else that I know there's one other. I think the Elgato. I want to say it's either the Elgato or the Belkin. It might be the Belkin, John, that does that. I can't remember, but yeah, that could be a good thing for you. Good stuff, right? Thunderbolt's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Who makes the, does this? Yeah. Apple makes one, I think. don't they?
Apple makes one what? Oh, a Thunderbolt. A Thunderbolt to HDMI. That's right. Yes, right. They do. Yeah, they do. They totally do. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Fun stuff. All right. What else do we have? You know what I want to do, John? I want to talk about our first sponsor for this show, which is Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. And Squarespace, these folks figured it out. They know that lots of us, for lots of different reasons at different times, want to be able to put a presence on the web, right? Maybe you want to start a blog, right? Maybe you have some stuff you want to say and you just want to have a place where you can get that out. Maybe you have something you want to sell. Maybe you make arts and crafts or any kinds of thing, right? Maybe you knit sweaters and you just want to sell those and you want an easy way to get that online. You do something else and you want to have your presence on the web and you want to do it easily without a headache and quickly and also without breaking the bank. Well, that's what Squarespace is here for. They have gone and they've gone through all the trouble for you. They figured out how to host a website. They've figured out how to design a website. They've figured out how to customize that design of a website. And they've figured out how to do it for less than 10 bucks a month. And that's what they sell to you for less than 10 bucks a month. In fact, it plans start at just 8 bucks a month. And it's so easy. You don't need extra software. You really don't even need any skills other than knowing what it is you like to see on the web. Visit squarespace.com. Go to squarespace.com/MGG because that's one of the ways that you'll let them know that we sent you there. But really what they do is they go through and you just start and you pick a template. They've got all these templates right there. And it's fantastic. What they do is they have, you say, I want to have a storefront. I want to have a blog. I want to have something. And then, you pick a template from the group that is built just for that. And they've got their own pictures in there, but you can put your own in. They've got their own designs. You can put your own in. And it's built for mobile. It's built for desktop. They do such a fantastic job with this stuff. They've got a partnership with Getty Images. So if you want to have something specific in there, but you don't want to go take that picture or create it or anything, just they've got it. That you pull from their library, it automatically fits into your thing. It works great. The best part is you just go and start designing. Visit squarespace.com/MGG and start designing. When you're ready, you get a 2-week free trial right out of the gate. And then when you're ready to buy, remember coupon code MGG because that'll get you 10% off. So yeah, $8 a month is their starting price. You get 10% off of that. And they really do a fantastic job with everything. I mean, they take months for each of these templates. They make them all responsive so you don't wind up with weird URLs if somebody's visiting on an iPhone. Everybody gets the same URL. It's all normal. I host my DaveTheNerd.com blog there. And it's super easy. I used to host it on my own. I know how to do this, right? I've done this before once or twice. But in terms of just making it work, it's simple. And if I want to change the design, I change the design. All my content migrates in. It's super easy. So check it out. Squarespace.com/MGG. And then remember, coupon code MGG to get 10% off on your first purchase. And we really appreciate it. If you use that coupon code, because A, you get 10% off and we like that for you. And B, it's another way that they know that we sent you there. So thanks again, Squarespace, for sponsoring the show. All right. Is it time to go to Dave? I think it's time to go to Dave. Right, John?
It's time.
You know, I have things laid out. I have a bigger screen here and I'm having a harder time finding things because they're not exactly where I left them. On the 20-inch, but that's not a complaint.
Your muscle memory is trying to.
Hey guys, it's Dave. Quick follow-up comment in regards to episode 534. About 45 minutes in, a guy wrote in about fonts in regards to passwords and being able to distinguish between a lowercase L, uppercase L, etc. He was doing it in a plain text file, but I'm actually using LastPass, and I kind of have a similar issue. So I mean, I work around it, but it kind of drives me nuts. So one of my passwords has a lowercase L and also an uppercase I. And for whatever reason, the font that the LastPass app on iOS uses, they look identical. You can't see a noticeable difference between those. So, I mean, most of the time you can just fill it with Safari or on your computer it fills. But I've had a few case uses where, say, I'm at a friend's house and I need to log into one of my websites or whatever using his computer. It's too much of a pain to go install the LastPass extension and all that nonsense. So I just pull up the password on my phone, look at it, but for the life of me, I can't tell between the lowercase L and the uppercase I, so I end up having to do it 15 times with all the variations until I figure out which one's what. So I think that's kind of what that user was getting at. I kind of have the same thing, just curious what you guys think of that. Thanks.
Yeah, you bet. I think that LastPass is using the wrong font to display this information to you, because that sounds like a bad thing. You use LastPass, John. Is there any way to change the display font in there?
I'm going to take this in a different direction, Dave. Is that if you run the LastPass client on iOS and you want to get the password, to another app?
Yeah, but he wants to read the password and type it into his friend's computer. Right. I mean, that's the if you just want to copy and paste, right, that's easy. But
because that's one of the menu choices. Yeah. So if you click on any of the sites, you can say copy password,
right,
or show password. But right. I see what you're saying.
Right.
Huh.
Yeah. That's the whole font issue becomes the problem. I mean, and a workaround for that would be something like Disconnect or something like that.
Right. But I use 1Password and they very specifically use the courier font. That delineates all of that stuff and highlights they highlight numbers in a different color than letters in 1Password, if I'm not mistaken. I know I've never had a problem telling
L and I
the difference. Yeah, I know. Now I gotta look. And
Dave and I are madly opening 1Password.
Yeah, and so in 1Password, numbers are the color blue and letters are black. So it makes it really easy to tell the difference. And it's a monospaced font. It's bold. It's easy to see. So it sounds like LastPass just needs to update their UI. Or if I might be so bold, maybe, you should migrate to an app that already has a better font. There you go.
Yeah, I've just never run into that issue.
Right. Right. It to be fair, it's interesting that we've had several listeners now write in with this use case. I don't know how many times I've had to read a password to type it. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we manage our lives a little bit differently. Everybody manages their lives differently.
It's interesting. The L and the uppercase I is slightly bolder, but I'm not sure you could tell.
Yeah.
If, next to each other, you can tell the difference.
I wonder but
it may be a different font.
Yeah. I wonder if like iCloud password, or iCloud keychain, sorry. And I know we got too much stuff over here for you, Pete. Pete's crashing into everything today. We got a lot of stuff piled up where he normally is. But I wonder if programs have been written not to use either of those characters in their auto-generated passwords.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be smart not to because of that potential confusion. Obviously, if you're doing it on your own, then you could put in whatever you want. But that would be yet another thing. But again, we're talking about this from a programming standpoint. So I don't know what the right answer is. If you can't read it, you can't read it. And that's a known quantity right there.
I know what you could do, Dave.
Go.
It's new. Well, I don't know if this will help this case, but
sure.
You probably got this in your box, but LastPass recently released a Mac client, mm-hmm. native client.
I did see that.
So run
have
that.
You launched it? Have you played with it yet, John?
Not quite yet.
Okay. I kind of figured you would be right all over that.
Well, what they're... I'll have to do a comparison because, I mean, the thing is now... The plugin, does everything I need. The Safari and the Firefox extension.
Sure.
Do everything I need. But
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. They wanted us to tell you about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that would solve this particular problem.
No.
But it is a good thing to know about. I'd like to see that. In fact, that's fantastic. All right. You want to take us to Jesse?
Yeah, this was a fun one. And by fun, I mean, this came out of left field. So, Jesse writes in and says,
hey, hi, guys. Hang on one second. I'm gonna interrupt you on Jesse just so that we can, Pete pointed something out to me real quick here about 1Password, yeah, just to tie this up.
I got in there, and one of the things, you can create your password recipe, and there's a checkbox in there, which is avoid ambiguous characters. So if you go into your, I don't know about LastPass, but with 1Password, you have the ability to set your recipe not to do an uppercase I and a lowercase L right next to each other, that sort of thing. So
that's really smart.
Yeah. So yeah, it's there. You can uncheck that if you want and make your life harder.
Yeah.
Because you can.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks, Pete. Sorry, John.
Yeah, you bet. Sorry,
okay,
guys.
Okay, take us to the top of Jesse, if you would, please.
So, Jesse Ronan, he gave us the overview of his system. I don't think it's really important, but it's the details. But he's got an iMac, a Drobo 5N, and an Apple AirPort Extreme. Well, I think that's actually part of the problem. So he's been experiencing a bizarre issue with his Drobo that he's hoping we can diagnose. He moved and purchased, a new AirPort Extreme for his new apartment. Upon setting everything up and attempting to connect my Drobo over a wired connection, nothing showed up in Drobo dashboard. My Drobo is on a static IP and it would give me the chance to log in via AFP or SMB. But connecting to a share would basically crash my Finder and eventually lock up my computer. At no point during the Finder crash was my connection to the internet lost. I attempted this 2 more times to ensure it wasn't a freak accident. The problem persisted until I tried connecting via wireless. Then for some reason, everything worked fine and everything showed up in Drobo dashboard and accessing of data was business as usual. I've run through all the possible steps I can think of. Power cycling devices, purchasing new Ethernet cable, contacting Apple support, that found my router was defective and replaced it, but the problem still persisted. And even tried to talk to Drobo support. Nothing seems to work and everyone is stumped. Here are the crash logs I sent to you. And he sent the crash logs. And so I looked through the crash logs, Dave. And sure enough, there were many AFP-related messages where it was timing out. It was saying, hey, I'm trying to connect to this thing. And basically, it never responded. So it gave up.
That's not good.
So I don't know if I should even go over the suggestions I had because they were wrong. Well, maybe I'll go over briefly. Maybe you have some commentary here. So one thing that I saw in the logs was IPv6. I have heard of people having issues if IPv6 isn't set up properly on all of your devices. So that's one thing you could do. On the computer, it's in Network Advanced Configure IP6, and there are settings there. And also in AirPort Utility, if you go to Internet Options, Configure IPv6, there are also various options there. I would say in general, you want them all to be at the same setting on all your devices, but that wasn't it. The other thing, and this is where I thought the problem would be, is that you want to make sure in network that you set the service order. What's that, John? Well, I'll tell you what that is. If you go to System Preferences and then you click on Network, on the left, you're going to see a list of all the interfaces that are available to connect to things. Ethernet, Wi-Fi, maybe Bluetooth, FireWire, whatever. You're going to see them there, and they're going to be in a certain order. But you know what, Dave? That order is lying. Well, not lying, but one would reasonably assume, oh, the order that I see them in is the priority in which the computer will address them. Well, that's not the case.
You sure?
How do you force this? I'm pretty sure, because I've seen where they differ.
But whatever's at the top is the one that has the main connection.
I don't think that's always the case. Sometimes it can get out of sync. That's been my experience.
Really? Oh, because I've seen it. Like, if I go, I know where you're going with this, right? With the gear menu and set service order. And I've seen it where if I have both Ethernet and Wi-Fi connected and I change the service order, it actually reorganizes the list that's in the network screen. I thought that was supposed to show you. Now, it may, of course, you know, we're talking about Yosemite here, so anything's possible.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. What I've seen is that's not always the case. So just to make sure that the interfaces are being used. As you said, so there's a little gear, or I think it's called the action menu. And if you click on that, you're going to see an option, set service order, ... And then it's going to give you a list of all your interfaces. And that is going to show you what order they are, what order they're addressed in. And you should have the one that you're using most at the top of that list. And you can just drag them around. So I was thinking that may have been the case because he was mentioning that he's using different interfaces and it sounds like he may have them both on at the same time. So I thought, oh, that's a reasonable assumption. Well, that wasn't it either.
Okay. No, you're right though. I mean, it's good to, if you're going to be doing advanced stuff and having two interfaces going is advanced, even though it happens all the time without people even realizing it. It's good to know what you've got as a priority and how that management is going to happen. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, personally, now I threw in a little bit of wisdom here. Personally, Dave, I like to have only one interface active. So what I'll do is I'll create a location and set all the others to inactive. So there is no chance of using another interface without my knowledge.
But that's just me. I'm with you on that. I feel the same way. I mean, I've mentioned that I used to manually set my interfaces so that Wi-Fi and Ethernet were actually the same IP address. And then I did what you in the last show told us not to do. And that worked great for years. And it would still work today had I not gone into the console and just looked at things. And I saw this slew of errors just streaming in there saying this IP is in use, but I'm going to use it anyway. And it's like, yeah, because you're using it. And so I don't do that anymore. But I really don't have computers that migrate between Ethernet and Wi-Fi anymore. If I have to use Wi-Fi in the office, it's because I'm having an Ethernet problem. Or sometimes, like if I'm programming a new router, I'll use Wi-Fi to connect to the router, the one router, and then Ethernet, you know, to connect to the internet. And that can actually be really handy because you can be talking to something that's not connected to the internet over a different IP range. And yet still have access to the internet with Ethernet. So yeah, you can. But to your point, to stop us down this rat hole, yes, it's probably best to only use one interface at a time. Certainly simpler.
Right. So.
So what did it turn out to be?
I gave all the suggestions.
Yeah.
You know what it turned out to be? It turned out to be. I still blame the airport partially. Now here's what happened. Then he said, you know, I remember, so this is totally out of left field and I haven't even thought of asking about this because it didn't occur to me.
Sure.
Then he said, I fixed my problem. I remember way, way back you guys, and by you guys, I think he meant me, suggesting that you can change if you're on a gigabit Ethernet network, there's something known as jumbo packets.
Yeah, that would be
which is also the MTU, and I think that's maximum transmission unit.
Transmissible, I think, but
transmissible.
I think. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Now this is something that you can set.
Transmission, you had it right. You got it right. Yeah.
Right. So this is something you can set. So you can either set it automatically and the computer will try to make the best choice, or if you think you know better, like me, you can set it manually. Some people believe that setting it manually, especially on a gig, certain networks can handle a larger MTU. Now, why would you want to make an MTU larger? Traditionally, an MTU for Ethernet is about 1,500 octets. Can I say octet and sound all old school? Is around 1,500. So at a low level, what this is the amount of information that's sent in a single network packet, and then the other side confirms it and checks that it's correct and all that stuff, and then the other side sends more. But you know, 1500, I mean, that's kind of tiny. What if you could make that bigger? In theory, And I proved it to myself, though I think you get a marginal increase in a performance here.
I'm going to refer you to the Wikipedia article on confirmation bias there, and we'll just let that go.
Well, the way it's supposed to work, but Dave, I mean, it's like if I gave you $100 in nickels or in quarters, I could give it to you quicker in quarters, right?
Yes, that's correct.
That's when we're talking about quarters. So the thing is, if you set the MTU larger, and here's the caveat, and this is where what happened here, and all the devices on that network have the MTU set to the larger value, then things will move along faster, right?
Theoretically.
Here's the problem.
Logically, it sounds correct. Theoretically, I'm not sure. I haven't done the research there, but logically, I'm with you. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've done the research, and I've seen it squeak out a little bit more performance. It's probably not worth messing with, but I like messing with things.
Right, of course. No, I get it. Right.
Here's the problem, though, is that if any device on the network is not set to this larger value, then you're going to get what's known as fragmentation. Now, the thing is, some devices don't handle this situation very well. What should happen is if one device, and the problem really comes in is, say one device is sending a larger packet and then the other device is expecting a smaller one. What it should say is, whoa, I can't handle all that. Can you break this up into smaller pieces that I can understand? That's what's supposed to happen. The thing is, that may not always happen properly. And actually, in some of my testing, Dave, I remember this actually happened when I was fiddling with my my old boat anchor G5 machine. I actually had a situation where if it wasn't set right, if it was receiving something that it didn't expect, it would actually throw a kernel panic, poorly written driver.
that's super handy.
But what could also happen is that you may not connect to things. And that's exactly what was happening in his case here. The reason, and now that he says it, now it kind of makes sense, because he said, hey, as soon as I switched over to wireless, everything was great.
No surprise.
So yeah. I think what happened, so what he did then is I think he finally, I think this is, so what he said he did, and I think this will fix the problem, is that he does have it set to 9,000 on one device, and I think... I think what happened is that the Mac, for some reason, had reverted to automatic. So what happened is that it was doing 1500 and the other devices were doing 9000. Once he set the one device, I think the computer, back to 9000, then everybody was happy.
Huh.
So that's the problem with doing that stuff. You do it and it works great and you forget about it. And
yeah, you reinstall OS X, right? You do some sort of network reset on any one device and now everything falls apart.
Yeah. You're like, oh.
Yeah. So, I bet you're right. I mean, certainly, like I said, logically, it makes sense that there's got to be at least the potential for a performance gain going to jumbo packets. But I don't see, there's certainly not enough performance gain for what most of us are doing to warrant doing that and then creating this scenario that you're totally going to forget about. I'm hoping that this big, long discussion we've just had kind of cements this in all of our heads, that any of us that are doing this, or if you're helping troubleshoot a friend's network, you at least think to check that as one of the first things when you're getting this network wonkiness. So what was his initial, just to wrap this up, John, the solution was, get your MTUs in sync, either all 9,000 or all 1500. What was the 10 word description of his problem so that we can all kind of cement this into our heads that way? What was the symptom he was seeing?
Well, he wasn't able to connect to his NAS.
But he saw it. He just couldn't connect to it, right? I mean, it would appear on the network, but he couldn't get an active connection going. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, sweet. Yeah.
Right. And the logs would back that up. The logs were saying, connection timeout or something.
But not saying
along those
why.
Lines.
Yeah.
If they'd only said, hey, packet mismatch or something like that.
Right.
Would have helped.
Might have said, hey, well, wait a minute. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The moral of the story, don't touch a nothing.
Well, but then where's the fun in that?
I know. I'm not saying it's fun. I'm just
it's true. Morals of stories are never fun.
That's right.
Okay. I'm wondering if
morals are never fun. There you go.
Sounds
there's
like
a show theme.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if maybe buried somewhere the the device that was having an issue may have been logging, or I don't know if there are any logs on that Drobo. Maybe they were saying, hey, I'm getting packets that aren't right, man. What's going on here? But the computer wasn't reporting it. So, all right. So I guess the advice here is don't touch your MTU unless you're me.
The moral to the story is never fun. I think that's the title of the show. There we are. All right. That's good stuff. That's good stuff. Helma writes, she says, I hear you talk about microphones often, so I hope you can provide me with a suggestion for my problem. At work, we regularly have Skype sessions where some of the team members are in a room and some are on Skype. For the people on Skype, it's very hard to understand the people in the room when they are not sitting in front of the laptop that has the Skype session open. Surely this is obvious since the audio setup on both Macs and Windows computers are designed for communication between persons sitting in front of their computer. But it's a pain to have someone repeat everything that has been said or have everyone huddle around the laptop. So I wondered if you could give me a suggestion for a modestly priced microphone that I can plug into a Mac or Windows machine, preferably USB, that can be set up in a central location on a table so that it can pick up the voices of everyone sitting at the table. It'd be nice if this could double as a simple improvement over the internal mic when we decide to start making screencasts, but it means no hard requirement. Okay, so this isn't entirely a simple answer. Microphone choice has as much to do with what you're trying to record as, or capture in this case, because you're not actually recording, what you're trying to capture, in addition to the environment in which you are trying to capture it. And the room you're in, any room, sucks, it typically, because you don't, and this is true of this podcast, right? And we actually had a pre-show sort of discussion and troubleshooting going through some of this stuff too. You don't want to hear the sound of my room being pumped into and then added to whatever it sounds like when all of this signal is sent into your room. Now, if you're listening on headphones, maybe that's not bad, but maybe it is. But you know, certainly if you're listening in your home or your car, that's got its own bounciness and environment sound, and you don't want to hear that. So that's why we get right up on our microphones when we talk. You know, and I'm set up so that the gain's not quite right for me to do this. But if I get back over here, you know, you can still hear me, but you also hear me bouncing around in my room. If I did that for the whole show, you might actually hate that.
Yeah, I'd listen about 4 or 5 seconds and go, well, done this week.
all set. Thanks, Dave. Yeah. So, you know, what you are trying to accomplish is getting the voices loud. And what I did, you know, as I got closer to the microphone, so you get far more of my voice. My voice is still bouncing around in the room exactly the same as it was when I was over there. The difference is, my voice is much louder to the microphone here because I'm much closer to it. And that's the problem you're trying to solve. You're trying to get the voices louder into the Skype microphone than their echoes that happen in the room, the reverberations that happen in the room. That's not, you know, the easiest way to do that is what I just did. Get closer to the microphone. It's what you've been doing. Get closer to the microphone. Now, are some microphones better at this than others? Yes. The microphones in laptops typically are on the keyboard, right, on the bottom tray, aiming up. Sometimes they're on the top bezel, oftentimes they're also aiming up. That is bad because, you know, where's the sound coming from? You're speaking, you know, horizontally at it, and the microphones are aimed vertical. So they're going to get more of the reflection off the ceiling. You could get a microphone like the Blue Yeti. It's a USB mic. It sits up on a pedestal, and it's actually got three elements in it, and you can set it in single direction, omnidirection, bidirectional, and set different patterns. You can experiment with what works for you, but all of the elements on that microphone are aimed horizontally. So that could help. It also means you could get the mic closer to the people that are speaking. Maybe what it does is it makes sense to put it between you and have it in the bidirectional mode, which is they call interview mode. It tends to reject off-axis sound a little bit better. But this is not an easy problem to solve if you just want to have a microphone in the fixed location. in the room and just talk. But the Yeti would probably be the right thing to get as close as you're going to get without breaking the bank on this. Skype also tries to do some of this some echo cancellation and things like that. And it actually does a fantastic job. If you turn that off, you'd hear how bad it really is. I think an easier solution, though, is to get a microphone that is handheld that you could pass around inside the room. It is, you know, that, and if you get it, you know, with a long enough USB cable, then you can just pass the mic around to the people that are talking, and that might work a lot better. Along those lines, Audio Technica makes a couple of great microphones. The one I recommend these days is the AT2005 USB. It's sort of the newer, I'm not going to call it little brother, it's different shaped brother than the ATR2100 USB, which was a very popular microphone and still is a very popular microphone out there. The 2005 USB is $10 cheaper at $50. This is a cheap microphone, inexpensive microphone. I actually just bought one this week so that I could have a microphone, a handheld microphone in my travel case. And so for $50, you get the microphone, which is a handheld mic. I like the 2005 because it's got a flat grill, whereas the 2100 has a rounded grill, which is a little weird to speak into. But it's got the flat grill. $50, you get the microphone, a little tripod-ish desk stand, a clip for the microphone, and two cables. You get a USB cable for the mic and an XLR. These microphones, both of these that I've mentioned, the 2100 and the 2005, have two connectors on it. So you can connect it to a normal mixer with XLR or USB to your Mac. I tried it here in the studio over XLR. It actually sounds fantastic. I would have no trouble using this thing on stage, and I've tried it connected to my Mac, and it sounds great there too. It's a dynamic mic, which means it's going to pick up less of the room sounds than a condenser mic, which is active. So this could be the magic for you, is having one of these to pass around. One additional benefit that I will point out is this microphone, that both of these, I'm 90% sure on the 2100, but I definitely sure on the 2005 is powerable by your iOS devices. So you can plug it directly in by way of the USB camera connection kit to your iPhone and record directly on your iPhone with a high quality mic. And that's why I wanted to have it. So I have an easy portable microphone that I could plug in. Now, unfortunately, Skype on iOS doesn't currently let you use the microphone that's plugged in to the camera connection kit. Every other app does. Skype doesn't. I've reported this to them, and they're actually taking a look at it this week to see if that's an easy fix, because that would be a great thing to have. So that might be your solution. If you want something that's got multiple elements in different directions so that you're not getting bouncy, I highly recommend the Yeti. I've used that mic quite a bit. I normally do not like condenser mics for this type of purpose, but the Yeti does really well. It's got a gain control on it, which really helps kind of temper a lot of that stuff. Don't get the Yeti Pro. That's a whole different beast and probably going to drive you crazy. Its gain is too hot and it's got a weird sound pattern on it. But the regular Yeti's great. But at $150 for the Yeti and $50 for the AT2005, I'd start here and see if you can pass the mic around. So, and the Yeti is not bus powerable by the iPhone. It needs more power partially because it's a condenser mic and needs all that power. So
I wonder if Kiwi Graham also said something in the chat room, which was kind of offhanded, but I think maybe work, which was just try the iPhone using Skype. It's got sound, noise canceling and all that, or is that directional?
Well, it might work better. You know what? The microphone in the eye, that's a great suggestion, Kiwi Graham, because the microphone in the iPhone is built to do a lot of this echo and noise rejection because it's a phone. We all forget that it's actually built to do that, and it does it pretty well. Yeah. So, yeah, actually, that's an interesting thing.
You may already have the equipment.
You may already have it. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Any thoughts on that one, John? I mean, I know you're not as much of an audio geek as I am, but I know you spent time in the ham radio and not ham radio, but the CB realm. So I wasn't sure if you had any thoughts on microphone setup or placement for picking up, you know, groups of people.
Not really. What did I use for bass? I used the D104. Looked like a lollipop. It's a nice mic. In Ake Mobile use, I had an amplified mic, which we'd all fiddle with to try to get more oomph out of. There were some tricks you could do to those. Yeah. My buddy Bob was always helped me out with that stuff there. And actually, it was funny because, you know, I talked to him, Dave, on my computer, speaking of the built-in mic. It was actually neat. The other day, I was kind of, you know, I was working on the computer, and all of a sudden, it starts beeping at me. And it's like, phone call from Bob. And I'm like, oh, that's right. Handoff or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I actually took the phone call on the Mac, and actually he said, you know, it didn't sound horrible. It actually sounded, you know, halfway decent using the, you know, built-in mic and the microphone and the, so I could hear him. Yeah, it's actually awesome. A well done feature.
All right. Let's see. Yeah, we've got two. I think we got time for these two about monitors that are left. So let's let JP take us into that realm.
Hey, John and Dave, it's JP in LA. Quick question.
I'm going to pick on JP for a second here because it factors into the last conversation. You can hear that JP is not right next to his microphone. It's fine. We're going to let it go. And please, when you send in audio comments, don't worry about it. We'll deal with it on this end. We try to do some EQ and make it work. We would just like your audio comments in. But just as an example, I'm going to pick on JP for a second here. And you can hear the difference, and you can hear the bounciness of his room. So anyway, take it away, JP. We will now that I've pointed this out and laser focused everyone on it, we're going to ignore it.
Hey, John and Dave, it's JP in LA. Quick question. I have I have two 27 inch Thunderbolt displays on my desktop here connected to my Mac Pro. Whenever I'm watching a video on Vimeo or YouTube, I click the full screen button in the video player, and I get the full screen of the video playing on one screen. However, the other screen goes to black and nothing appears on it. Is there any way to tell Safari or this computer to, hey, leave that second monitor alone, let it show what it shows, and only full screen on the one monitor? That'd be genius if I could watch full screen on one monitor and still see my desktop on the other. Is that possible? Can't believe I've never even asked this. Please cut me off.
You have been cut off. And you probably heard his sound got a little bit better. I just swept the EQ a little bit.
Magic.
To find where, you know, typically that bounciness of a room happens in a certain range. And so I just sweep the EQ a little bit to find that bounciness and dump it. And that thins out his voice a little bit, makes it less bouncy. So, you know, there you go. I think we've got an answer for you, JP. Maybe. I think the answer is go into system preferences, go into mission control in system preferences, and check the box that says displays have separate spaces. This will require changing that setting, either turning it on or turning it off. Will require a logout or a reboot to take effect. But I think this will do this. I have one setup where I have two monitors, and because it requires a logout, it's a pain in the neck to test anything like this. But I seem to remember that was a function of it. I don't prefer this, not because of your scenario. That would actually be quite handy, but because it also then kind of, you get the weird moving menu bar and dock, and apps sort of act differently, and you can't easily drag things between spaces and in ways that it's a hack. Honestly, Apple wanted to solve this problem, but they didn't want to have developers have to rewrite all their apps. And so I think the only way to do it was to kind of adopt the spaces mentality and have, you know, spaces, things on different displays. So I got to try it again. Maybe it's gotten better, but I think regardless, JP, I think that's going to solve your problem. So do you do the dual monitor thing, John?
No. Only got one monitor.
It can be a fun thing.
Well, on this machine, well, now, you know, actually I have done a little bit because now, you know, the portable supports many WhizBang features, including, I think we call it air display mirroring.
Yeah, right.
So I've done that on occasion, you know, extended what I have. I think I can do dual monitor to the, cause yeah, through the Apple TV, I can mirror my content.
Yeah. Totally. Totally. All right. Let's see how we do with this. Hopefully that works for you, JP. So Chris writes in, he says, I have a 2011 Mac Mini, the one with the 2.5 gigahertz i5 and a discrete graphics card, which is listed as the Radeon 6630M. I have been using it happily with a Dell 23-inch monitor, but recently added a second monitor, and that's where the trouble began. I purchased an inexpensive Philips 23-inch and connected it via a third-party mini display port to DVI adapter. Right away, I noticed my mouse lagging and had problems with the machine rebooting. I changed the adapter to an Apple one, which fixed the mouse lag. However, the reboots continue. The machine is fine when I'm using it. However, about a half an hour after I walk away from it, the Philips monitor suddenly will display a white screen with a message, which I have not been quick enough to catch. Then the machine reboots into an unusable state. Background is black, menu bar and dock are missing, and a constant series of fatal errors from my apps. The only solution is to pull power and then it restarts normally, except the desktop backgrounds are messed up. I checked in the logs and he sees things that say GPU reset, GPU restart, report start, and things like that. I wondered if the half hour before the reboot was significant. I discovered that my display sleep setting is 30 minutes, which is about how long it lasts before a crash. I can't for some reason turn display sleep to never, but I did turn computer sleep on and set the display sleep to the same value, and that seems to avoid the problem. I'm wondering if it's an incompatibility between the firmware on the monitor and the Mac. Maybe when the Mac tries to put the display to sleep, something in the monitor firmware crashes my GPU. My question is, do you think buying a different monitor might fix the problem? Should I try a different DVI cable first? So this is a weird one, John. I have an initial theory on this, but I'm not convinced that I'm right. It's just a theory. Let me back up a little bit. Apple has a really, really bad history with GPUs in their Macs, especially the quote unquote lower end GPUs. Okay, so whatever the lower end GPU is, that's the one that's going to fail. Not guaranteed to fail, but if it's going to fail, that's the one. I don't know what it is, but graphics cards and Macs just aren't reliable. So it's for that reason, and add that into the fact that, well, that the machine that now sits in front of me here in the studio just went through its whole graphics card issue. And that's the first thing I jump to is, okay, well, it is a Mac. And it's a Mac Mini, so yeah, it's got the discrete card, but you know, I don't know. I feel like that's where it is. So it's worth doing the Apple hardware diagnostics, which is done, I believe, just holding down D, or is it Command D? I always forget. I always hold down Command D and that works, but you know, it's worth running Apple hardware diagnostics, which you should have right on your Mac to test this out. And even if not, you know, as we've mentioned, the Genius Bar will do these diagnoses for free. So it's worth bringing it into them if only to rule it out. They'll diagnose the graphics card and all of that. But the fact that it's happening when it's supposed to go to sleep could mean that it's the graphics card and that it's there's some the way the OS is doing things. It's asking some additional capability or something from the graphics card as it's going to put it to sleep, and then that's what's causing the issue. But it could just be an incompatibility between the two. The way to test that would be to add a different monitor to the mix and see, or maybe even swap the two. I think you said they're connected in two different ways, so swap the two and see if the problem happens or just run the Philips monitor. So you're not running two monitors and see if the problem happens with just the Philips monitor. Cause it doesn't happen with just one monitor. When you go to put it to sleep, it does happen with two. So if you take the Dell monitor out of the equation, again, this is just kind of, you know, as we like to say, honoring the troubleshooting process. But yeah, check it all out. And I'm hoping, I'm actually hoping it's the monitor and not your GPU, but bear in mind that it very well could be. So that's my thoughts on this, John. I don't know, but I don't know. It's hard to say, right? That's the whole deal. What do you think?
It is. I don't know if I have much to add here, except, yeah. You know, I did actually have, as of recently, a graphics-related problem. I'd never seen this dialogue before. It happened on my 2012 MacBook Pro here. It was very strange. I'd never seen this error message before, Dave, but then this has, you know, different graphic hardware before. This has, you know, both the, you know, high and low performance graphics. But I got a dialogue the other day. So the machine had like totally wedged, like no control whatsoever. And then when it restarted, so, you know, I held down the power button, which as you should all know, but if you don't, that's the one way to, that's like the Hail Mary of if your machine is crashed and you can't do anything, hold down the power button. And that's almost any computer. You hold down the power button for like 5 seconds and it shuts down. Now, you want to avoid that because, you know, there may be disk corruption or all sorts of things. But this was the only thing I could do. And when I rebooted the machine, Dave, I got a dialogue from the OS saying a graphics problem has been detected. And click report to submit the report. You know, the two options there, ignore a report. But I actually was able to find, so it actually logged this in the in one of the crash reports on the console. And it actually had a similar message. It was like a, you know, GPU reset or GPU drive. I think it may have been the graphics driver just had a big problem. I've never seen it again. So it's not like it's not a recurring issue. Again, I think it was just, but I'm with you. Apple, actually, thank goodness, because actually, you know, my 2008 machine, actually, I got an entire motherboard replacement because I think they filed it under a defective GPU thing with NVIDIA. I guess they had a lot of back and forth with them at times. And so they actually diagnosed it as, well, yeah, your problem, even though the problem manifested itself as the USB bus kept restarting and that was in the console, but they actually said, nah, it's really the GPU. We'll give you a new motherboard. It's like, oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, on some machines, it's, you know, baked right in. And so, yeah, you got to go the whole logic board route. I did just buy AppleCare for this machine, for the Retina iMac. I figure it's the first of its ilk. I should be covered as long as I can. And AppleCare is cheap on iMacs. It's like, I think Apple's price is $169. I paid $115 or something from LA Computer Company.
Yeah, it's so amazing. You can shop around for AppleCare. It's great.
Yeah. LA Computer seems to be, no one beats their price. Except eBay. And
really?
Yeah, but it's questionable. Sometimes I've had people register correctly with an eBay that purchased AppleCare, and then like a month later, Apple comes back and says, actually, we processed your thing and you're no good.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, but LA Computer, I've never had a problem with.
Can you buy AppleCare Plus from them, or is that only from Apple?
No.
I've never tried.
AppleCare Plus is only for an iPhone.
Oh.
I believe.
And iPads.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's cheap on iMacs. You know, it's like $300 and something for a laptop.
Worth every penny. One fix and you've got it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. But I don't see why it's cheaper for an iMac, because the parts aren't any less expensive.
And the shipping's more.
So, exactly. <you know. laughs> Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I know. But anyway, I'll take it for $110 or whatever, $115, yeah, whatever I paid for it from LA Computer. It was like, yeah, done. It's good stuff.
Yeah, I know that was a bit, I got to get that too.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, that's funny because, so you can get it within a year, at least.
Yes.
That's interesting here. So I see, so the list price for Mac laptops, 15 inches and above, is $350.
Yeah, but you can get it for like $242, right? From LA Computer, man.
Well, I just found it on, I have it bookmarked here in Amazon. It's $244 from Amazon.
Yeah, see, there you go. Is that free shipping from Amazon?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. So that's probably cheaper than LA Computer. But if you tell LA Computer about that, they will match that price. Yeah.
Well, for, you know, $2, it's like, yeah.
Right.
Haggling.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I should get it. I think for a portable, no question, you should always get AppleCare. For other, you know, I didn't get it for my Mini, and I don't regret it.
I didn't get it.
And then I never had a problem with the Mini.
I didn't get it for this iMac, the my original 2011 iMac, and I wished that I had, because in the end it all worked out fine. But and I would have been out of the AppleCare warranty period when I had all these issues with the, you know, the graphics card or whatever. So it probably wouldn't have mattered. But the Ethernet port on the motherboard had gone out in a weird way. It would only do 100 megabit. It wouldn't do gigabit anymore. And that happened maybe 18 months in. And it was like, well, I'm not buying a new motherboard just to fix Ethernet. That's when I got a Thunderbolt dock or whatever. So I definitely would have. I wish that I had on this one, which is why I bought it on the new one. So it's fun. It's crazy, right? That's how we roll. That's how I think, anyway.
I guess we're not going to get to... We'll get to this next time.
Yeah, we're done. All right. We talked about all the social media ways of contacting us, which is fantastic. But if you want to email us, feedback@mattgeekab.com is the way to do that.
You guys always bicker about this. Let me set the record straight. One time here, now, and finally, it's feedback@mattgeekab.com.
You know, I'm glad you're here, Pete, because, you know, we need someone to set Dave straight. And it is feedback@mattgeekab.com.
It is. It is.
I'm glad you two are past that.
You're right. That's right. Thanks, Pete. Yeah. It only took almost 10 years. Yeah. That's right. 206-666-GEEK is the phone number to call. And Geek, John, is?
4335.
Indeed. I want to thank Michael Johnston for taking the time every week to convert this show from its unchapterized form into its chapterized form. Michael, you rock. Thank you. You should check out his podcast. He does a great show called The iOS Show, which I think appeals to probably, you know, 80% of the folks that listen here. So go check that out. Michael's a great host. I also want to thank the folks at Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth that gets the show from us to you. They rock too. The podcast marketplace includes, as I mentioned, Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. Barebone Software, barebones.com. Gazelle at gazelle.com to sell all your stuff. Linda, LYNDA.com/MGG. Gets you a 10-day free trial there. Drobo, MGG50, gets you 50 bucks off a Gen 3 Drobo. And, of course, Smile. At smilesoftware.com, makers of great stuff. I actually have an anecdote to share about PDF Pen Scan Plus that we'll talk about maybe in a Cool Stuff Found show. In fact, John, I'm thinking it's almost time for one. The queue is getting big. I know.
Your wallet will be getting thinner.
Yeah, well, that's how it works, doesn't it? All right. John, do you have any final thoughts for us today?
I think Pete should tell us what he thinks.
Well, if I were you guys, as we go out there this week and before the show next week, whatever you do, don't get caught.